Kristen. This is Michelle from Paragon Cause, and you're listening to CFRC on 101.9 FM.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, a queer history of Newfoundland. That and more in episode 451, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Welcome to yet another new episode of Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, as well as Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, a flashback to my 2024 interview with award-winning journalist and author Rhea Rollman, who joins me to talk about her Canadian queer history book, A Queer History of Newfoundland. A book that was a number one Amazon.ca bestseller in local Canadian history. We'll find out about A Queer History of Newfoundland and so much more. Plus in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some Canadian new wave, some Canadian queer 80s, and more. All that lies ahead as we start journey 451 through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning creator Tilly Bridges reads from her latest book, Begin Transmission, The Trans Allegories of the Matrix, tracking one person's transition journey from Thomas Anderson to Neo to Trinity. By the way, on Amazon.ca, the audiobook has a rating of 4.9 out of 5 stars.
The Matrix is a confirmed and intentional trans allegory written and directed by two transgender sisters, Lily and Lana Wachowski. They weren't out as trans when the first three movies or the Animatrix were made, but publicly came out as trans before the fourth movie. This changes the context for some of the films, which we'll discuss along the way. I want to remind you that these movies are fantastic humans versus machines sci-fi movies, and that the first absolutely revolutionized action movies and special effects, and there's also entire religious and philosophical metaphors to explore, All of those things are well worth discussing. The movies are so dense and have so many layers, I'm in awe as a writer. But I'm only going to talk about the trans allegories. Please don't take that as an indication I don't think those other things exist or aren't worth discussing. It's just that these allegories are so densely packed with detail about the trans experience that it's going to take this entire book to explain them. Note that the very name, Matrix, means a set of rules and procedures that define how something works. The society we all live in is our matrix, and yes, it does have you, well, many of you. It's the cisgender binary we're all forced into at birth without our consent. It restricts us and harms us in all sorts of ways, which these movies will show you time and again. Neo's our lead, and the Matrix is about his journey in coming to terms with the fact that he's transgender. Reloaded is about all the ways society comes for you once you're out as trans and wondering if we would have transitioned if we knew how hard life would become. Revolutions is about dealing with our own internalized transphobia and where we might be able to go in the future, or where we hope society might go. Resurrections is about detransitioning and retransitioning and the co-opting and erasure of trans voices. But we have to go in order for everything to make sense. Neo always presents as male in the movies, of course, but remember this is allegory and the first movie was also made in 1999. Here we are over 20 years later and we still don't have a transgender sci-fi action movie lead. We can't hold that against them. The surface level story is about Neo accepting that he's the one, and there will be much more on that later, but his journey is a trans one. His chosen name, Neo, literally means new. His dead name is Thomas Anderson. Thomas means twin, and Anderson means son of Andrew, and Andrew means manly or masculine. This means his name roughly translates to twin of the manly or masculine. This is your very first indicator of just how intentional these allegories are. You don't accidentally pick a name that means twin of the masculine for a trans allegory. And even if you somehow did, if that was the only evidence, then sure, maybe it's a coincidence, but it's only the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. Morpheus, in mythology, is the god of dreams. In The Matrix, Morpheus is Neo's superego and subconscious, and knows of his dream to be his true self. He knows the truth about Neo and spends every movie trying to help him accept it. Cypher is Neo's id and his doubt. A cipher is literally a secret, a code that hides the truth. It plagues Neo, eating at him. His id is so sure that he's in fact not trans and would be all too happy to just never think about it again. Neo's doubt is later personified by Link and then Bugs, but those are very different kinds of doubt that we'll discuss when those characters appear. Trinity is Neo's self-actualization, the person he wishes to be. Her name alone tells you she's Neo. 1, the ego, Morpheus, 2, the superego, and Cypher, 3, the id, all rolled into one. Trinity's in balance, in harmony, a whole person. Also note, she is a woman. The other three are men. Neo has to reconcile these supposedly male aspects of himself if he ever wants to attain self-actualization. Note how similar Neo and Trinity look, even down to their hair. None of that's by accident. Everything in a movie is a choice. And not only does this also hold through all four movies, I submit to you it is the entire point of all four movies. They tell the journey of one person from Thomas Anderson to Trinity. Agent Smith begins as the personification of society and the passive transphobia it exhibits by designing a system, the cisgender binary, that does not even account for the existence of transgender people. Over the course of the first movie and then through the sequels, he comes to represent active transphobia, the parts of society that acknowledge trans existence, only so they can then attack it and try to make it impossible for us to exist within it. Other important things to know before we start. The Oracle is Neo's heart, later replaced by Bugs. Tank is the trans community, later replaced by Zion and then Io. Locke is Neo's fear. Niobe is Neo's confidence, and the color red is vital to understanding all four movies, wherein it stands for unequivocal truth. Know that it stands for truth now, and the explanation for why that is will come early in discussing the first movie. Blue stands for doubt and yellow for fear. Always. The mixture of these colors is also used to convey more complex things. Purple shows you there's truth and doubt. Orange shows you there's truth and fear. The green overcast of the original trilogy shows you the world the cisgender binary matrix has created is based in fear and doubt. Yellow plus blue equals green. All agents, police, and security guards across all movies are cis white men. This is also intentional. It's showing you who benefits from the false cisgender binary, who set it up, and who extracts power from it to keep themselves at the top. This is also why the architect and the analyst are cis white men. These are the bedrock of the allegories. The foundation of everything else is built on and used to say all that the Wachowskis have to say. The good news is these are explained to you through the movies themselves. We're going to go through them all in order, not exactly frame by frame, but it might as well be for as much as these movies have to say. To truly understand the allegories, you'll need to go in order and read them in the order written, in the order of the movie's release. Jumping ahead will only lead to confusion, so I don't recommend it. But technically, you can if you want to. I mean, I'm not the boss of you. I can only show you the door. You're the one that has to walk through it.
When we talk about the LGBTQ community as if it is something that just exists, I think we're indulging in wishful thinking. Communities aren't something that spring fully formed from the ether. They require some assembly. They need to be constructed. Still thinking about the 70s here, when I came out in Toronto, there were lots of different parts that didn't quite fit together. First, there were gay men who went to bars and baths. Most were pretty deeply in the closet. They shared a dirty secret and some overlapping friendship networks, but not much else. Then there were a self-proclaimed clutch of young activists around the body politic and the Gay Alliance Towards Equality, myself included, who tended to be a bit judgmental about anyone not properly out and willing to throat ram. In fact, one writer to the body politic called us the high principle Jesus Christ farts of the movement. Then there were the new class of gay entrepreneurs who were establishing the first gay businesses along Church Street. The Community Homophile Association was perhaps the largest organization in town, and it was run by George Hislop, a part owner of several of these businesses. The entrepreneurs saw the activists as troublemakers rocking a precarious boat, and we saw them as conservatives unable to embrace gay liberation. We felt much the same about MCC, the major gay-focused Christian organization at the time. When women from Chat, calling themselves the Cunts, broke off and denounced Hislop as a sexist in 1971, it made clear that a lot of women were also on a pretty different wavelength. Most lesbians were much more comfortable in feminist circles than hanging around with gay men. Not that they all agreed either. There were always the lesbian socialist feminists versus the radical feminist lesbians, and so on. Trans organizing was small and generally had little to do with any of us. Trans men were often concerned with distinguishing themselves from lesbians, and trans women were unwelcome in most lesbian spaces. Gay men were generally suspicious, unclear on the differences between sexual orientation and sexual identity. So it was all a bit of a hot mess. I suppose if you see community like a dysfunctional family where everybody fights all the time, you could call it a community. But if by community you mean people who are cooperating and fighting for a common goal, that probably didn't really happen until the 1980s, when we were all faced with challenges that we couldn't overcome alone. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Coming up next, a queer history of Newfoundland.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Rainbow Country. When high school teacher Ann Escott took her recess break that pivotal day in May 1974, it was a routine morning. Escott worked at Bishop's College, where she taught physical education and biology. Midway through the morning, she joined other teachers in the staff room for recess. The women preparing lunch for the students turned on the radio to a popular phone-in radio program that aired daily on CJON. None of this was unusual, but what Escott heard next caused her jaw to drop. The host of the program was interviewing a man named Norman Hay, who was a member of Gay Ottawa. Hay was visiting St. John's and had reached out to CJON offering to talk about his work with Gay Ottawa. They invited him in and put him on the air. When Escott tuned in, Hay was chatting about his work and said he was perplexed as to why he could find no sign of organized gay community in St. John's. "Where are all the Newfoundland gays?" he demanded, in a tone of bemused frustration. Escott was floored. The visitor from the mainland was out and proud, a far cry from most Newfoundland queers at the time. Escott was a teacher. If she was outed as gay, she could be fired for it, thanks to clauses in her contract, colloquially referred to as morality clauses. So I was sitting there, sort of zombie-like, pretending not to pay attention, but actually paying very close attention, she explained to me. She remembers the broadcast quite vividly. I thought he was incredibly brave, because some of the people phoning in were just horrible. Others were quite supportive. I was just elated. I couldn't believe someone was actually doing this. As soon as she could, Escott slipped off to find a telephone. She phoned her girlfriend at the time, Sandy Pottle. I said, "There's someone on the radio and they want to get a group together. Has anybody gotten his information?" This was long before the internet, but the informal queer phone tree was already in operation. Pottle replied that another friend had just reached out and gotten his contact info. Apparently, at least a dozen gay people had phoned CJON looking for his contacts. There was going to be a meeting with him the following night. "It was so wonderful," recalled Escott, of the day she heard Hay on the radio. "It's hard to explain. It was wonderful, but terrifying. It was a mix of emotions. It was like, oh my God, there are other people out there who are doing this, and on the radio. And maybe we actually can do something and not be murdered or killed." That morning's program set off a powerful buzz in the city's still largely underground queer community. Those who heard it discussed the remarkable interview and decided that if mainlanders could get on the radio and openly ask, "Where are all the Newfoundland gays?" it was time for the Newfoundland gays to get organized.
Rhea Rollman, hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I am well. Thank you for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this, Rhea Rollman, returning back to Rainbow Country. I believe we had our first conversation a couple years ago, I think. But you are an award-winning journalist. You are the director of programming at CHMR-FM in St. John's, Newfoundland. You are part of the LGBT community. But let's start here. A Queer History of Newfoundland. This is a new book, your book. Talk to me essentially about what are within the pages of A Queer History of Newfoundland. Let's start there. What are within these pages?
Okay, so the book covers queer activism and community building in Newfoundland in the 20th century. So the first few chapters look at the early 20th century, mostly snapshots of the lives of some of the queer characters we know of from early Newfoundland history. But the bulk of the book focuses on the community building and activism that took place from the 60s until the end of the 20th century. So I look at the chronology of the different organizations that came about, their fight for human rights protections, which finally, sexual orientation was finally, they succeeded in getting it into the Provincial Human Rights Code in 1997. So that's kind of the end mark of the book. But in addition, I also have chapters looking at trans activism, how that took off, the AIDS crisis, the AIDS activism that went on in the province. I look at like homophobia, how that manifested in the different institutions in the province. And we end off with a look at kind of an overview snapshot of the queer bar scene, the queer club scene, and how that developed in St. John's in the 80s and 90s.
Is it fair to say that this is a history book?
It is, yeah. When I started out, I initially thought it would be mostly an archival history. So I was planning on putting together kind of the chronology of activism that took place in the province. But the more I delved into the archives, you know, the archives were partial, you know, they were incomplete. There were a lot of gaps in the historical record. There were inconsistencies, you know, sometimes newspapers would report the same events very differently. So it was hard to get a concrete picture of some of these events and some of the chronology. So I started reaching out to some of the activists, you know, who were mentioned in the early news reports, folks who were activists in the 70s and in the 80s. And I began doing interviews. And that took the project on a whole different turn. So by the end of the book, I had done about 150 interviews as well. So it shifted from being purely an archival history, which is what I had planned, to being at least partially, if not mostly, a community oral history as well, from all those interviews that I wound up doing.
Do you think that how things grew and evolved in Newfoundland, do you think it's unique, especially when it comes to the LGBT community, do you think it's unique to Newfoundland, or are there similarities to how things evolved within Canada at various, you know, LGBT communities, like in Ontario and Toronto, compared to, say, in St. John's, Newfoundland? Are there similarities, or are they vastly different, do you think, how these communities evolved?
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting questions that I try to explore with this book. And I would say it's a combination. You know, there were some differences, some very stark differences. The geography, you know, Newfoundland is a really, really big province with a very small population that is strung out across, you know, these very tiny rural communities all across this vast geographic landmass. So one of the challenges that the early queer activist groups had was how to connect, you know, all these, the queer community together. And, you know, they sometimes were criticized by queer groups in other provinces for not necessarily being as radical, as political as some of them. But what everyone recognized is that the Newfoundland activists were incredible at the outreach they did. If they received a letter from some poor, you know, gay kid growing up in a community of 25 people, you know, like that's, you know, 10-hour drive away and there aren't even roads, they would fill up a van of activists from St. John's and drive out and spend the weekend, you know, supporting that kid or find a way to bring them into St. John's to meet folks. So they did incredible networking and outreach work. One of the other big differences, and this was a huge one, was that when Newfoundland joined Canada in 1949, there was a referendum. Before that, Newfoundland was an independent dominion. And then in 49, there was a referendum. We voted to join Canada by a very narrow margin, like just barely 1%. And after the vote, there were negotiations over between Canada and Newfoundland over what the joining of the two jurisdictions would be like. And one of the things that the Newfoundland government demanded and Canada agreed to was that the Christian churches would control the education system. There was no public school system in Newfoundland until the late 90s. Wow. The churches controlled everything, and that meant they were exempt from, you know, once human rights laws started to be developed, they were exempt from them. There was horrific. It was traumatizing for generations of Newfoundlanders growing up in these church-run schools. And it was especially for queer Newfoundlanders, you know? So that was one of the big challenges. Some of the activists I interviewed, you know, they would have been, maybe they were kind of bold activists in university, but the moment they graduated and got a job, say, in the school system, they went back in the closet because they would have been fired, could have been fired if they were, you know, outed. And what the students experienced was terrible too. So that was a big difference. And that was one of the big challenges that the activists had to deal with in Newfoundland as well. And so there were differences, but there were also similarities, you know, it was really interesting seeing the engagement that went on between Newfoundland and the rest of Canada. You know, you had nationwide publications like The Body Politic, for example, did such a great job of letting folks across the country know what was happening everywhere. And they were really, the editors at The Body Politic, you know, they were really enthused by what they were hearing from Newfoundland. A bunch of them even traveled out to Newfoundland in the mid-70s just to meet the activists and see firsthand, you know, the community building that was going on. So there was a lot of unity as well. But it was an interesting dynamic, this kind of the push and pull of difference that I explore in the book, too.
So you just mentioned 150 interviews, pieces of archival material. How did you source out the people and the voices that you would hear from? How did you find these interviews?
That was a really interesting challenge. It took a lot of work. I would find their names in, you know, newspaper articles from the 70s. And then I would try and figure out, okay, how do I find this person? And I did a lot of, you know, searching through phone books and social media. I did a lot of cold calls. You know, sometimes I would call up 50 people with the same last name looking for, you know, were you a member of this organization in the 1970s, or I would
send
a whole
bunch. Were you gay back in the day?
Yeah.
Are you still gay now? Can we talk?
Yeah. You know, or sending messages on Facebook, you know, do you happen to be this person? Mm. And then also once I started doing interviews, then the people I interviewed started connecting me with other people, you know, so that helped too. And it was exciting. Actually, there were some cases where, it actually brought together old friendships. You know, people were, you know, would an activist I interview, they might remember, oh yeah, I was close friends and activists with this person and this person. And then they would go find that person and rekindle. There were some friendships that were rekindled, kind of cross-country friendships as a result of this work, which was pretty cool too.
How long did it take you to research and put this book together?
I had been kind of dipping in and out of these archives for quite some time. You know, in my work as a journalist, I've covered a lot of queer issues and stories. And so I had gone to the archives looking for information before. And I always thought that, you know, wow, this would make a great book to actually put together in one story. And so once I started doing that, took about, I don't know, 3-4 years of focused work, I'd say. When the pandemic hit, I had a lot of time on my hands all of a sudden. So that's when I really dove into it. We finally published a couple months ago.
And what inspired you to want to create this book? Was there a flashpoint? Was there a moment?
You know, it was actually those early moments of, I remember, I don't remember when, it was like several years ago, I was doing a story about Pride Week in St. John's. And one of the questions that occurred to me, it was like, okay, this is Pride Week. Is this the 20th Pride Week? Is it the 30th? When did Pride start to be celebrated? You know, and no one seemed to know. Everyone had different answers. So I went to the archives to try to find out. And that's where I found all these file folders of newspaper clippings, and a lot of them were, you know, literally crumbling to dust as I was looking at them. And, it really hit me then that, again, you know, this is an incredible story, and so much of it wasn't known, and especially by younger generations. And so I felt that I really wanted to, you know, put it all together, both to preserve the history, because a lot of it was being lost. There were people I interviewed who, you know, who died before the book came out. So, you know, a lot of these activists are elderly now. And it's so important to, I think, get their stories and preserve them. So part of the push was to preserve this history, but also to get it out there. You know, I was astounded by just the rich and exciting stories I discovered in the archives. And I think it's important for other people to get that. So I wanted to make it accessible to a broad public. You know, I wanted I work on campus, you know, at a campus radio station, and work with some of the queer groups, student groups on campus. And a lot of them have no idea of, you know, this early history that went on. So I think it's important that we talk about it. I think schools should be learning about it, both just to preserve it, but also when you look at the political, you know, moment we're in, I think it's important to have a clear and accurate sense of what our history was like, you know, of so that we when we see history being repeated, we recognize that. And also so that we, a lot of the thinking about the, you know, policies in schools and stuff, you know, we have those because of a past. We have those because of the terrible and tragic situations that the queer people were growing up with in the 80s and 70s and 90s. And so it's important for us to be aware of that history.
Did anything surprise you when you were researching, when you were writing, when you were creating A Queer History of Newfoundland? Did anything stick out to you, or multiple things stuck out to you?
The richness of it really, you know, jumped out at me. I had no idea. You know, one of the first queer activists, formal queer activist groups in the province, CHAN, the Community Homophile Association of Newfoundland, they were founded in 1974 and they operated until around 1980. You know, I knew nothing about them. And when I first heard their name, I figured, okay, it must be like a small little group. But they were huge. You know, they had... within their first 2 years of operation, they were in contact with over 1,000 people across the island. You know, they had over 400 paid members in their second year. You know, they were regularly bringing out 40, 50 people to biweekly meetings. And I knew nothing of this. You know, there was just such a rich history of organizing. So that really astonished me. And the more I read, the more I realized, you know, there was just such a rich history. I mean, myself growing up as trans here in Newfoundland, you know, when I was growing up, I thought I was the only only trans kid, you know, because this stuff wasn't talked about in the schools or in the media at the time. So it really stunned me in a lot of ways to once I started really doing research to discover there were so many other people also growing up trans here in the province. A lot of them left the province, and I tell some of their stories, you know, in the book. But it was really jarring to realize, wow, okay, you know, there were others, and who went on to lead such remarkable lives as well. So yeah, it's once you start scratching the surface, it's really amazing. Mm-hmm. The hidden stories that were just waiting to be found.
Mm-hmm. And the title, A Queer History of Newfoundland, was this always the working title, the title, or is there an interesting story behind choosing this particular title?
Yeah, I struggled with the title a lot. When I pitched the book initially, the working title was The Queer History of Newfoundland. And I figured that would be an easy task, you know, just tell the chronological history. But once I started doing the work and realized how complex it was, I was like, oh no, there's no way I can fit all of this into one book. So I felt it wasn't really fair to call it The Queer History of Newfoundland because I was going to have to leave so many stories out. Just the book's like 526 pages. The original draft was over twice that size. So I struggled with a bunch of other names, but finally, myself and my publisher, we came back to the title A Queer History of Newfoundland, you know, so this is not the be all end all definite, you know, there are other queer histories to be told of this place, but this is a queer history and it's as exhaustive a one as I tried to tell, as thorough as one as I could, but there are definitely other queer histories to be told. And I hope that either myself or others will have the chance to do that. You know, ever since the book came out, I've had folks reaching out to me, adding their stories, offering to share their stories too. So I hope to be able to collect and maybe get those out as well at some point in the future.
Volume 1.
Yeah.
To be followed by Volume 2 and more.
Perhaps. Joey Shulman was born in St. John's and grew up there in the 1950s. He was living in Toronto when the bathhouse raids took place in 1981 and was present in one of the bathhouses that was raided. He was arrested. It was for him one of the moments which reminded him how quickly societal tolerance can shift. It was a lesson he'd initially gleaned from reading about Oscar Wilde, who one moment was celebrated by British society and the next shunned and imprisoned. Shulman's own experience in the bathhouse raids underscored a similar theme. "We need to learn from our past," he says. "No matter how uncomfortable we get as gay people, there are always people like Hitler, people like McCarthy in the 1950s US, people like the RCMP fruit machine, the bathhouse raids. The bathhouse raids happened at a time when we felt so liberated. We were out in downtown Toronto. We were living in entire apartment buildings downtown. We were fabulous. We were exploding. We were just like Mary Tyler Moore, throwing our hats in the air. And then suddenly the police just clamped down." It's important for younger people to know that this was a real attempt to stop us from finding and having and sharing love, Shulman said. And that shouldn't be allowed. People came out of that defiant. It was our Stonewall moment. We took to the streets and we won all those rights that ensued.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast to coast.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues, to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support, tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So, Rhea Rollman, you are an author. You are a member of the LGBT community. You are an award-winning journalist. I believe 3 Atlantic Journalism Awards. Congrats on those. Being an award-winning journalist, especially in times like these, like very politically charged times, you are part of the LGBT community. You were talking earlier about being transgender. But being an award-winning journalist, do you feel that lends more credibility to yourself, especially when people may look to you and who you are and your background and maybe try to dismiss that because of who you are? But yet, being an award-winning journalist, you can then turn around and say, well, you know, I've got some cred here. Do you find that, do you put credence on being an award-winning journalist, especially in times like these politically charged times?
I suppose it helps in some ways. I'm a little bit skeptical of awards anyway, because they're always kind of random, and there's a lot of people who deserve awards who don't get them. so I'm a bit skeptical of them as institutions, but certainly, you know, it was important to me in putting together the book. I approached it journalistically because I wanted it to be accessible, but I also wanted it to be, rigorously researched. And so there was a lot of work that went into, you know, trying to fact check whatever possible research and cite stuff. So, you know, we've got references for a lot of the content that's in there. And in fact, you know, it was quite a rigorous process. You know, I would interview folks and then go back and forth with them, you know, trying to correlate what they were saying with the archival records and, you know, figure out any inconsistencies or, you know, so there was an important process of certainly having the journalistic background, I think, helped in trying to make sure that the book was, as accurate as possible.
Mm-hmm. Work ethic.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're also the program director at CHMR FM in St. John's, Newfoundland. How long have you been at CHMR?
Oh, golly. I've been, I started volunteering at CHMR as a teenager, you know.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I was doing shows and then I did my undergrad and then I moved away for several years and then came back. So I've been program director here since for about 6 years now, maybe. Mm-hmm. That's a bit of a guess.
But you definitely have a long history with the station in general.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Earlier you were mentioning about being transgender for yourself. Looking back, did you always know that aspect of yourself, or is this something that you recognized later on in life?
No, I mean, yeah, no, I had a very early sense of that. I'd say by, you know, grade 3-4, definitely. I had a sense of that, but didn't really have the language, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. weren't being taught terms like trans. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the labels to put on it, but I had a very clear sense that that's what I was. And it was later when, I did come across, you know, finally these terms, probably in a medical encyclopedia, in an encyclopedia or something, that I was like, oh, okay, this is a thing, you know, there is terminology for that. You know, this was pre-social media era. So, because this stuff wasn't being taught in schools, because there wasn't really a public dialogue about it, it was really difficult to learn anything. And that is a very similar story to what others, what I heard from others, you know, in this book who were growing up around the same period or earlier. You know, there've been one of the earliest trans stories in the book, is the story of Jeannie Shepherd, who grew up, in the 50s she was from a rural community called Sandy Point. It was a small island off the coast of Newfoundland. I managed to find and interview her sister, and her sister said it was basically a deserted island that she and 13 siblings grew up on. As early as they can remember, you know, Jeannie was the one who was, you know, absconding with their skirts and dresses and dancing around, on this desert island. And it was only later, when Jeannie eventually moved to Toronto, that she, you know, connected with the trans community and then had a community and, you know, the language to put onto this experience of being trans. Mm.
In 2021, you wrote a powerful article in The Independent called Transforming Transition-Related Surgeries in Newfoundland. You wrote that in 2021. And if you can, what was the kernel? What was the essence of that article that at the heart of it you were getting at in that 2021 article? What were you getting at in that article?
I guess what inspired it was the need to talk about the inadequacies of gender-affirming healthcare in the province. And one of the ways I think in order to do that, I had to take a step back and show how gender-affirming care had developed in the province over the past several years. And it's interesting because in the book, I almost take on a bigger task. I was trying to, you know, take that history of the development of gender-affirming care in the province and push it back to its very beginning. You know, it was like, where did this actually start? And what were trans Newfoundlanders doing before there was a pathway to care, you know, through the healthcare system? So that was what inspired that article. And, you know, there was an overhaul of the gender-affirming healthcare policies in the province in 2019, which tried to bring in it did make some positive changes, but not nearly enough. It is still horribly inaccessible for a lot of Newfoundlanders, partly because of where we are. You know, you have to go to access surgery, you have to travel to other provinces because the services just aren't offered in Newfoundland. And there is a medical travel program the province has, but it's a cost share program. So you're paying at least 50% of the cost yourself, which most Newfoundlanders and Labradorians just can't afford. So there are huge, and there are other, you know, inadequacies and gaps. So I wanted to really shine a light on that, show that it's, you know, it is being done better in other provinces. What are some of the good ideas and how can we improve things in Newfoundland and Labrador? Because it is so important.
And you wrote that in 2021. It's been a handful of years now since you wrote that. Have things evolved and changed at all?
For the most part, no, which is really unfortunate. You know, there have been very minor improvements. One of the things I mentioned in that article is, it's almost not even worth mentioning. It's such a small change. There have been very minor improvements, but nothing on the kind of grand scale that would make the system more accessible, which is really terrible. You know, the StatsCan survey that came out last year revealed Newfoundland as being one of the most gender diverse places in the country. You know, we have a more gender diverse, and this is off the top of my head, from my memory, I covered the StatsCan report, but I believe we have a more gender diverse population per capita than Toronto, Montreal, or Vancouver. So it's an incredibly gender diverse place, but really difficult to access the medical supports if you're looking to medically transition in any way.
Mm. A Queer History of Newfoundland focuses on human rights, AIDS activism, lesbian struggles for space, trans struggle for recognition in healthcare. Here's my last question for you. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've read A Queer History of Newfoundland? What do you hope your audience takes away from this history book?
I would say a couple things. I would hope, first of all, you know, one of the important things for me was, and when I speak about the book, I always emphasize this, you know, I think it's important for people to know that we have such a rich history here in Newfoundland and Labrador. When I started reaching out to folks for interviews and I said, I'm writing a book on Newfoundland's queer history, there were some Newfoundland queer activists who kind of laughed and were like, oh, that'll be a short book. But the opposite is true. I mean, it's one of the biggest queer history books published of any province. and so that's what I emphasize, you know, the history of queer organizing in community building in Newfoundland and Labrador. You know, it's not a footnote in the broader national scene. It was as rich and vibrant as any what was going on in any other province. And in fact, Newfoundlanders and Labradorians had a big impact. You know, it was lesbians from Newfoundland who went to the National Action Committee on the Status of Women meeting in meetings that were happening nationally in Ottawa. That was the big national Canada's flagship women's organization, feminist organization. And it was the Newfoundland lesbians who pushed for lesbian recognition within that national group. And they got it. And they were the first ones to actually bring lesbian and queer issues to the meetings with federal MPs that NAC was having. You know, plus there were Newfoundlanders, it played a big role in the bathhouse raids and then the fight back, you know, Newfoundlanders who were living up in Ottawa or in Toronto. There were Newfoundlanders who were, you know, down in Stonewall. So, you know, Newfoundlanders and Labradorians have been very involved in this history, and have played a big role. So, you know, we're not a footnote. We're a big, key, important part of this national history. The other thing I hope people will get is to be inspired. You know, some of the stories are just downright inspiring. And I think at a time when we're looking at having to fight a lot of these fights all over again, it's important to learn from some of the creativity and the strategies and the ideas, you know, learn from what went before and also draw inspiration and hope from that, you know, to know our history and to know how to fight to remain vigilant and protect the gains that we've made.
Rhea Rollman, well said, well done, well written. Thank you. Thanks for your time. Thanks again for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. The stigma faced by those diagnosed with HIV was immense. Trudy Parsons recalled one community around the bay that she visited with activists Yetman and Upward to put off a workshop on a weekend. As they set up their materials and locals started filtering in, Parsons detected a strange atmosphere in the room. They were acting weird. I didn't know what was going on. They wouldn't make eye contact with me. Usually people will nod at you or speak or stare at you because they're mad, but they looked like they were holding a lot of guilt and shame, and I couldn't figure out why. They weren't even sitting with each other. They were all sitting with their backs to each other or turned away. I was like, what the fuck is going on? Then a fisherman guy comes in, and he's in his gear, and he stomps on in, and I thought, oh, great, he's going to give me a hard time, because he came in all aggressive. So we changed the order of speaking, and I got up right away, and I said, there's something going on here. What is it? You guys look like you're in a lot of pain. Then this woman turns around to the guy in the fisherman clothing and says, are we going to tell her? And he goes, yep. Then he says, we're ashamed. And I was like, okay, well, we're here to talk about difficult things. That was my mantra. We can talk about difficult things. So they talked about a gentleman that had come home with AIDS and they had crucified him. They just crucified him. The whole town. I can't remember the stuff that they did, but it was shocking. Absolutely shocking. They just did everything that they could to make the rest of his life as uncomfortable as possible, like throwing rocks at his house in the middle of the night and all kinds of really weird, fucked up things. And they were embarrassed about that. They were very brave in telling it, though. I couldn't believe they were sitting there and telling it. They were so brave. And they were committed to never behaving that way again. Like they were big grown men crying to break their hearts over their shitty behavior. It was something else. And it was more than just HIV. It was about homophobia, and it was about a man being considered what they said was sissy. It was all of that, too.
That was my 2024 interview with award-winning journalist and author, Rhea Rollman. A Queer History of Newfoundland is available wherever you get your favorite books and on Amazon.ca. It has a rating of 5. Out of 5 stars.
Bill 7. To ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, But without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, I Bitch, from Canadian indie trans artist, Trans Star, who's been creating music, electronic music, since the 1980s.
Anthony Alago, music executive, photographer, author, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Rainbow Country. This is hour two of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. So if you stay with me, if you stick with me, I hope you think I'm bringing you music worth hearing. Starting us off, a Canadian 80s new wave set.